Little known to the rest of the world, it was not me alone, and not Priya, but me and a gentleman by the name of Ronnie Rose, who co-founded an organization called Direct Action Everywhere, starting in 2012 and 2013. I'm really excited to have him on the show. And Ronnie, we've been through some adventures together. We've disrupted a lot of grocery stores and festivals and movie screenings. We have protested and been sued by some of the largest corporations in the world, and we've rescued some animals. So, but this show is really about rescue. So the first thing I want to ask you is just, what's your most memorable experience from that first rescue we did that launched the entire open rescue movement again in the United States back in 2015?
Oh, my most memorable. I mean, probably, well, I guess there's two components of it. The first time was the first time I ever been on any kind of factory farm before. And so I think, the first time I didn't even go, I didn't step foot on the property. We just drove to the farm, and my role for that day was to serve as a lookout. And I stayed in the car and served as a lookout with a walkie-talkie, mm-hmm. kind of just monitoring the area. So that was probably the most memorable just because it was really intense for me. Sure. Because it was the first time. But then the second time around is when I actually kind of stepped foot into the facility. Mm-hmm. And honestly, and I think this is what you hear a lot from people who go into any kind of these farms, is that just the overwhelming stench and yeah. the smell and how suffocating it is, like when you first step foot in there. And, you know, kind of the first thought is like, you know, I'm only in here for whatever, half hour, hour, 2 hours tops. But for the individuals living inside these places, it is, you know, this is their whole life and whole existence. And so that's memorable in kind of the negative sense.
Yeah. The chickens in these factory farms, and this place we first went to was a place called Petaluma Farms in Sonoma County. And it's a Whole Foods certified humane farm. And yeah, I remember, do you remember the packaging they had? Judy's Family mm-hmm. Farm.
Yeah, Judy's like Family Farm.
A little girl, a chicken, and she's like giving some food to a chicken in a grassy field. And it just seems like they're treating their chickens like, you know, a companion. And the facility that we went into, it has, these huge industrial barns, and there's like a few dozen of them. On each of them, they have these perches, you know, that the chickens are all crowding on. And underneath is a litter, what they call the litter, which is where all the feces and decomposing animals and broken, rotting eggs, just all the shit, literally shit, by the thousands of tons is accumulating underneath. And none of them want to be down there, you know. So they're all crowding on these perches, like smashed into each other on these perches. But it's exactly for that reason, because that smell is so terrible, that smell of ammonia and feces and decomposing corpses. And chickens have a very good sense of smell. So, you know, whatever we're smelling, I'm sure they're smelling a lot of other things. But yeah, I think it's something that a lot of people told me. And it's something you smell. Do you remember smelling it as we were walking up? Because they had those big vents.
Oh, yeah. And that was another thing. It wasn't just the smell. It was also the sound. It was just this really kind of overwhelming din of like I think it was a ventilation fan or something just going, you know, and it was really loud inside there too, which, you know, I can only imagine is a little disorienting to constantly have to hear.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what was most memorable for me from that experience. I don't even remember. Do you remember how many times we had been there before you came? Because you were certainly there one of the first few times. I don't think you were there the first time, but maybe the second time.
Yeah, I believe you guys went at least a couple times before, but I don't know how many times before that.
Yeah, I think the first trip, I think it was just three of us. I think it was just me, Cristobal, and Priya. And that was kind of wild, because I think the first time went, did I ever tell you the first time we went to the front, not the back?
I've heard the story, yeah. I'm glad I didn't do it that time, because if that was my first time, I'd be like, what the fuck is this guy thinking?
Yeah, I don't know what I thought. I mean, I think I know what I thought. So, you know, if you look at the map, it's obvious you should come from the back. And I'm not going to give away all the operational details, because who knows, maybe some open rescue actors will go back there someday in the future. But I think what I was thinking was we needed someone in the front to kind of scope out the threat points. because they have this big office in the front road. And I decided if we went through the back, I mean, we'd have to get someone to the front anyways, because we got to see what's going on in the front and make sure there isn't a huge truck coming in to take chickens out. Because, you know, there's not a lot of activity in the middle of the night in an egg farm, because it's not like they're processing the chickens every month or even every year. It's once every 2 years they clean out the barns. Mm. But there's a possibility even some plumbers coming in the middle of the night for some reason, or a worker is coming in to do some early work collecting eggs. You don't know what's going to happen. And I thought it was important for us to get eyes on the front of the facility. But we walk into the front and we realize, oh, there's like this house right there. And there's a family that lives there. And there's a truck. And the light turns on as we're walking through their yard right across from the farm. And we're like, holy shit, have we just ruined this entire operation? It was fine. I don't think they ever saw us. But I'm trying to think about what was most memorable for me. This might be just because I've seen the video so many times, which I still think is one of the best videos we made. But mm-hmm. I think just the moment we saw May, and especially the moment we picked her up, because I was the one who actually picked her up. And that was, it's just seared in my memory because it was such an intense moment, because we weren't really necessarily planning to rescue anyone. We had the capability to do that night, and we had a sanctuary we already had lined up, and we knew a rescue was possible. But honestly, yeah, actually, we didn't even have like a crate or anything. She was just mm-hmm. sitting on Priya's lap the entire way. So it was very spontaneous. And it was just, you know, we saw her on the ground and her like wing was all splayed out, all fucked up. And I radioed everyone. I've never asked you this. How did you respond? I mean, when I radioed you, when we were inside this farm and I said, I think we should take this bird out. Well, I mean,
so I was in there with you. I was inside with you. You radioed Priya, Crystal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was your reaction? I mean, how'd you feel?
I mean, immediately when I saw her, I knew she wasn't going to live. It would have been shocking if she even lived for the rest of the night. I mean, she had no ability to move. She seemed extremely injured. I didn't even think she was going to make it. And so, I mean, there was no question in my mind that we needed to get her out there if she was going to have any chance at surviving. And so I guess the second kind of most memorable thing is actually what happened afterwards is, pick her up, kind of assess her situation. And then we leave the facility. Right. But then the next morning, as soon as a vet opened, me and you took her to the vet, and that's where he like really kind of gave a pretty bad prognosis that mm-hmm. he is like, he essentially said, you just need to euthanize her. There's no point in even doing anything else, 'cause she's not going to live. And I remember you made a couple phone calls to people who had experience with chickens. I do remember who you called. Yes, I do. Yeah, absolutely.
It's funny because I called two people, if I remember correctly, but one of them is among them.
One of them picked up.
Personalities. Yeah, it was PJ who picked up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and PJ, I think he effectively said that he's like, vets don't know what they're talking about.
I know.
You know, he's like, you know, they're resorting to, you know, euthanizing when they actually have a kind of a fighting chance. And so you shouldn't take his advice and you should, mm-hmm. you know, try to give her some help and give her a chance to survive.
Yeah, it's so weird how even with dogs and cats, vets are so flippant about the lives of animals. It's like killing or not killing an animal. I mean, with human beings, I know this because my mom went through this long period of hospice because she had brain cancer and she died in 2015. I don't know. Did you ever see her when she was declining? Mm-hmm. I know you met her.
I never. No.
You never met my mom?
No, besides because I think she was in pretty bad condition shortly after you moved here. And so, I mean, she was in the restaurant when we first met.
That's right. So you met her in that context, but you didn't talk to her. Yeah. I know Priya met her. I mean, Priya, it was a little different because Priya and I were dating. So obviously Priya met her many times. But she was actually, when I first met you and we started DXC, she was cognitive. I mean, she was definitely declining, but she could talk. She could form coherent sentences. She could walk around. She couldn't drive, which is why I had to be in California, because we needed someone to drive her to get infusions at Stanford. And she's doing this experimental treatment for brain cancer. But I remember when my mom was declining, you know, it was like she was diagnosed with brain cancer in 2012. She died in 2015. So it was almost a 3 to 4 year process. And, you know, by year two, I mean, she basically had trouble even walking. So she was in a similar situation, a situation May was in. You know, like when we found May, May's the little hen we rescued from Whole Foods. You know, May was collapsed on the ground, couldn't walk. Could barely even lift her head. You know, if you remember, like her eyes were barely even open. And my mom was like that for almost 2 years. And no one ever said, just kill her, you know, just get rid of her. And there was this sense that her life is still so sacred. And I'm grateful for that, because I still remember one of the most just beautiful and powerful experiences to me that also really made me realize that we totally fetishize intelligence. Intelligence just doesn't mean a goddamn thing. It really doesn't, which is weird for me, because I grew up my entire life, I just thought intelligence was the most important thing in the world, because that's what my parents taught me, ironically. But my mom lost her intelligence and was not even able to talk. I still remember there was this one day, I mean, she was like losing the ability to say most words, but she could still say D. And D is my son in Chinese. And so she was like losing her words. And she would say it, and she couldn't even remember my name, you know, and she couldn't walk. She would just like lift up her hand and touch me on the head and say D. And it didn't matter that she couldn't say anything. It didn't matter that she had no intelligence. There was still this just incredibly intense love she had for me and love that I had for her. And that was more important than anything else, you know. Who gives a damn she can't talk? And, you know, honestly, like in a lot of ways, I felt the same way about May. Like, you know, I don't remember how much you were with me when we were bringing her back to life, but it was super intense. It was so scary. Like every day I was waking up and thinking, am I going to wake up to a dead hen? Have we just prolonged her suffering? And, you know, we've done our best to try and keep her alive, because we like ran it all over the place. We took her to a big sanctuary. We met Sherston for the first time. Do you know that's when we met Sherston?
Yeah, no, well, I didn't realize that until a little while ago. And I was like, wait, how did you meet? And I was like, oh shit, I met you at the same time that you met Wayne.
So Sherston's a veterinarian who's now become one of the most important expert veterinarians in the animal rights movement. I kid you not. She's testified in political, legal, legislative proceedings. She's one of the reasons I didn't go to jail in Utah, because she did such a good job convincing the Utah jury that these two piglets were totally messed up, that the jury sided with us and said you should have rescued them. But every day, you know, after taking May to Sherston, to all these other vets, to, I won't even say it, but some very prominent sanctuaries, and getting advice. I think there's one prominent sanctuary I can mention at this point. But the other person I talked to, I don't remember if I talked to her on the spot, but I definitely talked to Susie Costin about May too. Mm-hmm. Susie Costin, the former director and kind of farm animal, the shelter director at Farm Sanctuary, which is the most prominent farm sanctuary in the nation. And yeah, they all told me the same thing, that these vets, they don't really see the lives of animals, especially farm animals, very seriously. And, you know, they couldn't say for sure, but they thought we should fight and try to give her a chance. And that's what we did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there was absolutely that. I mean, I think it was that hope and seeing people who had a lot of experience around chickens and knew chickens really well, say that, you know, she's in a bad way, you know, she's in a very bad shape, but she does have a chance, you know? And so that just kind of, I do think that gave me hope. And I'm assuming you as well, that, you know, that's actually worth, you know, what we're doing. And it doesn't seem to be prolonging suffering, but she can rebound from it. And she did.
And she did. It was a fucking miracle, but she did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I still remember the first day that she stood, which didn't take her that long. I think it was like maybe 2 or 3 days. We don't know how long she was sitting there, but she might've just been so seriously dehydrated that, you know, I mean, not that she wasn't sick, and she was always messed up. I mean, even she lived another year before she died, and she was always kind of messed up, had some neurological deficits that I think the first vet diagnosed head trauma and said she either got smashed on the head by another chicken, hit by a worker. We don't know exactly what happened, but she's got serious head trauma because she has neurological deficits. But I remember like when she first started standing and the way she'd step, she'd be like, honestly, it reminded me so much of my mom. It was kind of eerie too. And my mom was dying at the same time, like literally. This is a year before my mom died, but my mom was declining because it was the summer of 2014, I think, when we rescued May. And the worst thing about it all is, you know, we're dealing with this hen who's gone through hell and was left to slowly waste away, literally in a pile of litter and feces, you know, with feces running around her. And the entire world, including the animal rights movement, is calling it humane and celebrating it, you know? I don't know. I've kind of softened my views about animal welfare and animal welfare advocacy. I think we should be careful to not attack other animal advocates who are doing other work. And a lot of the work is really important. You know, if people hadn't done the work on cage-free eggs and Prop 2 and Prop 12 to get to the point that farmers were advertising their products as free-range and cage-free, we would not have been able to expose it as a fraud. We would not have been able to show that they're all lying. But yeah, I mean, we already had a kind of a bad reputation in the animal rights movement. And I think, I don't know what you thought. I thought when this investigation drops, there are going to be a lot of people who really dislike us. Interestingly, even though Susie helped us, this is a little interesting. Even though Susie helped us, Farm Sanctuary as an organization had been very supportive of Whole Foods. So I felt a little bad talking to Susie because I thought, man, is she going to be mad when this comes out? But she wasn't. She
didn't care. I recall meeting with another kind of prominent person in the animal rights movement who will remain nameless. But I remember when we first kind of said, like, you know, this is the farm, and this was after the rescue, and this is going to be our new campaign focus. Our campaign focus is going to be Whole Foods. Like, they were very upset because they saw Whole Foods as being moving the ball forward in terms of kind of animal rights and animal welfare. And she was kind of livid that we would even propose such a preposterous thing as to have a campaign against a company that was doing so good, you know, and which was a little shocking. But I do think at that time, at least my recollection in the movement is that was the
everybody
that I mean, that's everybody. What everybody supported it, because maybe they didn't have this ability to dream beyond that. Right. And so I think that's kind of what we did, at least at that time in DXC. It was like kind of push that ball, you know, even farther.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny because I feel like there's a lot of grassroots support for our work, obviously, but especially within the institutional animal rights movement, I'm still sort of loathed. Like, this is the first year I'm actually going to speak at this Animals and Vegan Advocacy Summit, because the last couple of years they've rejected my applications. Which I think is the only time they have inside someone who's, you know, faced very serious criminal prosecution and been jailed, not speak. And same thing with the Animal Law Conference. You know, I'm litigating all these really big, important cases, getting the New York Times, published a piece in the Harvard Law Review, and the Animal Law Conference doesn't even have me speak.
Are they giving you feedback?
No.
You're just being rejected. There's no, like, this is the reason why. Okay.
Yeah, but I'm just reminded that the antipathy of kind of the institutional animal rights movement goes way back. And I think I know who you're talking about. The woman involved, she's kind of known as a radical animal rights activist too.
Yeah, that's, you know, what's shocking
and
about it.
It's like, and you're supporting one of the biggest corporations in the world and lying to the public. But yeah, I probably shouldn't name this guy either, but very, very prominent animal rights activist who's a dear friend who I love. When I told him about the campaign, he had the same reaction. He said, this is a terrible idea. And he said, and I'll remember these words until the day that I died, because I was a little shocked by them, because he just showed you. And I don't even think he was necessarily wrong in these words, but I don't know if I told you this, but I'll tell you who this was later. I'm not going to say now because I don't want to call him out. And also, I don't think he necessarily even wants to know. He wants people to know that he and I regularly consult behind the scenes. But he said, what's good for Whole Foods is good for the movement. It's good for Whole Foods, it's good for the animals. And I just thought, that's a lot. And this is a company that slaughters tens of millions of animals every year. And again, people didn't know this yet, but I knew there was other insidious stuff. Like, I already had started been digging into Diestel. So I knew Diestel was a complete scam. Diestel was a turkey ranch that had been marketing itself as free range. And they had a sham farm. They literally set up a fake farm so they could shoot photos and video and get certified as humane, when they're actually just a, you know, typical factory farm. But it was interesting because I think at that point, while we definitely talked about the risk of possible prosecution, we did, right?
Yeah, we did. I mean, I don't remember too many details. I think it was like, well, you know, it could be potentially a fine or, you know, 6 months or, you know, it was never, there wasn't a lot of precedent before that. So we didn't really know.
I did tell you guys about Adam Duran, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yes. So we all knew about Adam Duran. Adam Duran was the only activist up to that point who had served, you know, skipping prison sentence or jail sentence. He had an out sentence of 6 months. It actually only served 1 month, so he ended up serving the same amount of time as Amber Canavan. But while there is definitely a risk of prosecution we're worried about, my biggest concern was just the reaction to the institutional animal rights movement, because it was always just so hard, and there's lessons here for anyone who's facing a big kind of institution and trying to reverse it in some way, or even just trying to reframe it in some ways, that it's hard to do. And oftentimes when you're the dissenter, you get targeted very seriously. And and I was targeted, and we were targeted very, very seriously by the animal rights movement. And that had already started happening because we had done that Chipotle thing, and everybody loved Chipotle too. Like, Chipotle and Whole Foods were like the two-headed monster of animal rights that everybody loved, but we thought were monsters. You know, like, because Chipotle had that, you know, campaign that came out with that damn cartoon.
Yeah,
called the Scarecrow.
Yeah.
So bad.
Yeah, it was insufferable.
Yeah.
But I mean, great marketing on their part.
Great marketing. It's actually a great video. Mm-hmm. It's just all lies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and I think that was the point that we were trying to convey, is that even if they were giving more vegan options, right, that wasn't, they were obviously making people feel good about killing and torturing animals. Like, the fact that other people in the movement are, at least at that time, didn't see that as a problem or see it as a barrier to actually achieving animal rights. It didn't make any sense to me. And I do think, you know, since that point, and my view of the movement since then, it seems to have, you know, we won in that argument and that 100%. Fight. And we definitely pushed it in the other direction. And obviously it wasn't just us. There was, you know, other forces as well. But I do think we were kind of, at least in the US, you know, the most prominent in pushing that counter narrative.
Well, everybody's doing humaneness stuff now, you know, like literally Farm Forward, which was on the board of the Global Animal Partnership. So they were literally working with Whole Foods and certifying these farms as humane. They're the ones who just released that huge organic dairy investigation in the Atlantic with Annie Lowry. I don't know if you read that piece yet.
It's no, so I saw good. It floating around. I haven't guessed to read it yet, though.
It's so good. It's just beautifully written. Annie is just, it's so interesting because every time I talk to Annie in person, I feel like she really doesn't like me. But every time I see what she writes about us and grassroots animal rights activists, it's so beautiful and inspiring. I'm like, yes, I'm so glad. But I mean, it's a really disturbing article because she writes about, she tells a story of this one cow. I think it's cow number 13039. It's really, really vivid. But she talks about how this is, you know, one of three dairies that has been certified humane and certified as, you know, pro animal welfare under the Global Animal Partnership, which is Whole Foods humane certifying program. And they've used it in marketing. There was even a documentary made about how wonderful this farm is. And then what you find on site is all these animals like infected cysts and lesions. And the particular cow she sees at an auction, she sees this cow. She first walks up to the auction and says like, huh, that cow's got this weird thing on their head. And it's a denim patch. And the reason this cow's got a denim patch on their head is there's something called cancer eye, a tumorous lesion that's growing in her eye that's grown so big and it's gotten so infected. The eye is literally bursting out of the socket and being held in place by sinews. Like there, you can see the sinew strands holding this eye in place when they take the patch off.
Jesus.
And this cow is like terrified and suffering and trapped in this little shed. And then, you know, I think a day or two after Annie sees this cow who's raised on the supposedly humane farm, she gets shot in the middle of the head and between her eyes, between her, you know, infected, pus-filled, cancerous eye. I posted a photo on my Twitter that's just so disturbing. And it's not even a photo of the eye. It's just a photo of this cow trapped in one of these sheds. You can see how scared this cow must be and how much pain she must have been in for so long to get to that point. And this is the face of organic dairy. And this is, again, this is Farm Forward doing this. You know, I want to reach out to them and say, like, shout out to you. And and honestly, one thing I do regret is, I think, I don't know how you feel. I feel like we were probably a little too aggressive towards the animal welfare groups. Like, I think we had a little bit too much of a preachy tone towards the other animal advocates. I think we were right, and I think we've been proven right. The other thing that's amazing, did you hear that Mercy for Animals just released an investigation of Chipotle?
Oh, wow. No, I haven't.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
It's so cool. I haven't looked at the details yet, but I want to shoot an email to Leah at MFA. I mean, MFA's done some groundbreaking stuff. Mm-hmm. And Leah Garces herself has done amazing work over the last 10 years. But this investigation sounds really, really, really important. But yeah, but back then the movement was just, and it's complicated to understand why. I think money honestly did play a role though. It's sad but true, but Whole Foods was funding a lot of animal welfare organizations. John Mackey himself was, you know, among the world's most famous vegans, if you can call him a vegan, which I actually, I don't know. What do you think? Do you think we can call him a vegan?
I mean, he was a dietary vegan, I guess.
It's funny. I just had this conversation of vegan Gaines. Do you know what vegan Gaines is?
No.
And he said I wasn't vegan.
Oh, really? Why is that?
He told me I wasn't vegan because for a short period of time, when Joan was dying, I gave Joan non-vegan food. And he said, well, you're not vegan then. And he called me a scumbag and a hypocrite.
Okay, which, then.
Which I appreciated. I thought it was, I mean, like one of the things I like about vegan Gaines, I don't know if you watch any of his stuff, but he is very direct with people. He does not mince words. And I actually really appreciated that. And maybe I am a hypocrite. I don't know. But anyways, I think if I'm not vegan because I gave my cat non-vegan cat food for a few months before he died, and I did it because, you know, he was on prescription food and there's no prescription vegan food.
I had to give him this,
at least according to the veterinarian, which, you know, maybe I shouldn't have trusted the veterinarian. My cat was dying and he needed something to change, and, you know, we're trying whatever we could. But if I'm not a vegan because I fed Joan non-vegan food, then John Mackey certainly isn't a vegan because he was profiting off the slaughter of tens of millions of animals as a CEO of Whole Foods. But at the same time, John Mackey was also funding personally, from what I understand, a lot of animal welfare organizations. And he was on the board of directors. Do you remember this? Mm-mm. He was on the board of directors of the Humane Society of the United States.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do recall that. And the person that I mentioned earlier, she had a personal relationship with him, which could have influenced her.
There's so much weird influence and money going around. I don't know. And that's one of the beautiful things about the grassroots, because the grassroots, from day one when we started this, you know, I've evolved my thinking. I think money does matter to some degree, but from day one, we used to say, don't donate to us. We don't care. We don't want your money. Mm-hmm. You know,
didn't we have like an anti-donation page on the website?
We had a page that said, do not donate. Like that.
Yeah.
And so many people who were in advocacy reached out to me and us and said, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. Do you realize how much you're giving up? There's so many people who want to support you who can't support you, and you probably need their support. But back then I was a rich corporate lawyer, so I was like, I don't need money. I can fund it all myself.
And then, yeah. I mean, and like, we didn't have, I didn't think, I don't think we were doing enough kind of that warranted a lot of resources. So, which, you know, that obviously shifted, and my perspective on that has changed quite a bit too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think money does matter, unfortunately, but, and we were just blinded to that fact by the fact that we had, you know, a relatively wealthy co-founder, me, could fund everything initially, but no longer. So, yeah. But yeah, I think the movement has changed. I think you're right. And I think everybody understands the humane myth is a problem. And there's this survey data showing now, it's important that even the animal rights movement has an interest in this survey data, because this is survey data that I think was taken by the Sentience Institute, which is actually co-founded by a former DXC person, Kelly. But they did this, they've done this survey, I think, a few times now, showing that 75% of Americans believe the animal products they buy are coming from humane farms, which is a pretty astonishingly high percentage. Now, granted, maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe if they didn't believe the farms were humane, they'd still be buying animal products. But if nothing else, the fact that so many people believe the humane lie gives us an opportunity to win them over to our side and get attention. Because repeatedly, what we found, you know, it's funny because the animal rights movement, like most movements, likes doing the same thing over and over again. And back in 2012, when we started DXC, the thing that everyone was doing is just undercover investigations, right? Mm-hmm. Let's do another undercover investigation of a factory farm. Show people that farms are cruel. And that's fine and good, except people have seen it 100 times now. Like, literally, I think by 2012 or 2013, there might have been 100 undercover investigations of slaughterhouses and factory farms. And no one cared anymore. It was... the public and the media were becoming inoculated to that sort of expose. Mm-hmm. What they needed was something different. And what was different in 2012 and 2013, which is why we got in the New York Times on our first investigation, which is very rare. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the New York Times might have two stories about animal rights every year. And we got in the New York Times because it wasn't just about the abuse of animals. It was about the cover up. And that's an interesting story in a way that the abuse alone is not. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyways, so let's walk back and just, I think it'd be interesting for people to hear kind of how this all started for us mm-hmm. back in 2012.
Yeah. It was a chance encounter.
Yeah. Say more about that.
So at the time I had just graduated from college.
And summa cum laude.
Summa cum laude. Yep.
I didn't know at the time, but I knew you were smart because the moment I talked to you, I was like, all right, this guy's smart.
Which no, I don't think it's not smart. It's just, I know how to follow directions really well. And I got grit. I had just graduated. I had been, you know, obviously eager to get kind of do more because I felt I wasn't doing enough and just for animals. And so at the time, I think I was volunteering for a urban wildlife foundation. So I was kind of doing just like rehab, taking care of animals that, you know, been hit by cars or abandoned or what have you. And then I was also working with another activist organization called Santa Clara County SCA. Activists for SCA. Right. Santa Clara SCA. County Activists for Animals.
Best acronym and, ever.
Yeah, yeah. It's like SC, Santa Clara County, yeah. SCCAA, yeah.
SCCAA.
A, yeah. And
just like the music.
Like the music, except for that's SKA. Really.
Yeah, except the music, SKA. Yeah. And it's also dead. No one cares about the music anymore. Well, yeah, I guess ska is kind of dead too.
Yeah. No, ska is definitely dead.
They're both dead.
And I mean, at the time, it was mostly me and a bunch of older folks. Yeah. I mean, I think that the median age was, or the you know average age was probably like 60. And then I was here. It was me, this college grad, you know. But it was great. You know, we did like,
how old were you back then? 24, 23? Cause you graduated from college a little late. Cause you like did some other shit.
Yeah. I think I was probably like 23 or 4 at the time. Yeah. Okay. And so we were putting on this film screening called How I Became an Elephant, which was about this,
oh, that's right.
This young girl in Los mm-hmm. Angeles who he was trying to fundraise for some elephant sanctuary in Thailand. And so anyways, we were putting on this screening and I was going around to different places flyering. And so I'm at this vegan restaurant that's called Happy Bamboo, no longer exists, in South San Jose. And it was one of the only vegan spots in the area at that time. I think there was maybe two other vegan restaurants, three maybe in San Jose. And I'm there with my mom, putting up a flyer, asking them to put up a flyer and get some lunch. And I'm accosted by this man.
Who introduced strange me, man.
This strange man who's very interested in this flyer.
Strange man who appeared, yeah.
Yeah. And so
it's kind of an inside joke. There's a funny video we made where we narrated by saying, a strange man appeared. And it's me. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
It's the Lily video. It's actually went viral, but it's like such a stupid line in retrospect. Yeah. I'm like, mm-hmm. why did we do that? It sounds so stupid. It's like, because we're trying to narrate it from Lily's perspective. We say, a strange man appeared, and it's me showing up. But
a strange man
appeared for you, too.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. You're a strange man from many people's perspectives. Yeah, and so, you know, I hung up this flyer, and the thing I just remember is just out of the corner of my eye, I see you just get up from your table. And then just walk immediately over to the flyer and just kind of inspect it very, very seriously. And then you just look at us and then you make a direct line towards our table. So, are you guys animal rights activists? And so that was how we first met. It was very, very chance encounter. And you were not supposed to be.
And I thought it was you and your beautiful girlfriend. And it turned out it was your mom.
Mom. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I might have even said that to you later and had to eat. A vegan crow. I was like, oh yeah, you and your girlfriend, it was so nice to meet you both. And you're like, that was my girlfriend, that was my
that
mom.
Was my mom. That was my mom, thanks.
Hey, it's all the credit to your mom. Your mom's beautiful and young, and you know, I haven't seen her in years, and all the love to her. She was awesome, and we had a lot of meetings at your mom's house.
Yep. Yeah, no, she, Yeah, she's been a great supporter over time. But I do remember that I can't remember if you gave me your card at the time or you just showed up to the film screening and then we kind of talked afterwards and then I emailed you in response and like thanked you and then we just kind of kicked off a relationship from there.
We definitely emailed before because I remember, sorry to call you out a little bit, but I remember emailing you not getting a very prompt response. And then it was after the film screen, you wrote back in more detail and said, like, I'm sorry. It was totally fine because I was busy with my mom's situation. And I just started a new job at this huge firm, actually literally the largest law firm in the world, DLA Piper. Mm-hmm. And so I was pretty busy too. But yeah, you were the first animal rights activist I met in the Bay Area. And I had tried, you know.
What brought you out to the Bay Area? I mean, I know.
It was my mom. It was my mom getting sick. You know, so I was very happy in Chicago and, I was just in my own little rut, you know, it was weird because I thought all the same things I thought when we started Direct Action Everyone, I even written about them. Like I wrote Big Boycott Veganism in 2007, which is not at all what you think it is for all of you listening. Boycott Veganism is not actually about boycotting veganism. It's a terrible title. Mm-hmm. It was about how we have to get active and that. How to stop focusing so much on people's individual consumer behaviors and start thinking about direct action and systemic change and cultural change. But so I wrote that in 2007, that was 5 years before we even met. Right. And so that was a culmination of a thought process. So that was, you know, after years of thinking about it, which now I'm just aging myself. Cause people are like 2007.
Yeah. I know. Some people might not even have been alive.
Like, then. Like, yeah. They were like, I was born in 2007. I'm watching this video. But I had never thought of myself as an organizer. I honestly don't even really feel like I thought of myself as an activist in a lot of ways, which is bizarre. Because by that point, I'd already rescued a bunch of animals. And like, you know, I'd stolen a cat from the shelter. I told you the story about
tell
those
me more.
I stole.
No, I don't know. Wait, tell me this cat story.
I didn't tell you the story about stealing my kittens. Yeah.
Never heard this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of unclear what my first open rescue was, but there's an argument that my first open rescue was my own kittens, Joan. You know, you met Joan and Flash and Annie. But yeah, I'd been fostering kittens for the shelter in Chicago because I was a volunteer. And I had fostered these kittens. And one of them came down with this lesion, you know, like a weird lesion on his back. And it wasn't even Joan. I think it was another cat. And this is just another example of how flippant we are. I mean, flippant is just a euphemism. How grotesque we devalue the lives of animals, even cats and dogs. But so one of these cats comes down with a little lesion and, you know, I'm fostering these cats. So I tell the shelter, hey, one of the cats has this weird lesion. I don't know what's going on. I said, bring them in. They do some tests and they say, the cat has a ringworm. And the first thing that happened is they, you know, I like to assume good faith in me, in people, but it's hard for me not to think they just lied to me because I was a little inexperienced at that point. And now I know what ringworm is and I know it's no big deal. Like I've had a ringworm before. It's like athlete's foot. It's literally just a little fungal infection that if, you know, an animal's got an intact immune system, they're going to be able to fight it off. And there's plenty of good treatments for it. You know, just use some fungicide. You can buy it at Walmart. Just, I don't know what it's called. Do you remember talking about that athlete's foot medication that everyone knows about?
Yeah, Tenactin.
There we go. All you need is some Tenactin. Just go to get some Tenactin. The cat's going to be fine. But they told me this is a zoonotic disease, which is true. It can affect human beings. It could potentially kill you and other people in your life, your classmates. I was in law school at the time, your neighbors. And so we're going to have to take the cats away from you, but we'll take care of them here. And I was like, wow, that's really, really scary and disturbing. And I guess I don't have a choice. And, you know, I've got to leave these kittens who I've been caring for the last few weeks. I mean, I was bottle feeding them. And Joan was one of three who were found in a box in the freezing cold in Chicago and just left to die by someone and got brought to the shelter. And I ended up fostering them. And four other kittens and a mama cat and Annie, who you never met because she died in Chicago. She was Joan's mom, but not her biological mom. Annie had adopted Joan and she was an amazing mom. you know, like for weeks. And she was such a fierce, mean cat. Like she attacked me viciously. She attacked my dog. When I first brought her home and her kittens, I thought this is not going to go well. She's going to kill these kittens because she was like scraping the shit out of me and like biting me and hissing constantly. And she was such a beautiful mom. Like the moment, from the moment she saw Joan and these two other kittens, she didn't give a shit that they weren't her babies. She loved them. Hmm. And she cared for them so well. And I'd been watching them bond and I'd supplementing them with some bottle feed too for weeks. And then this ringworm thing happens. And they say, they're all going to have to be at the shelter. And I say, well, but I mean, isn't there a distemper outbreak at the shelter right now? That's why I had the kittens in the first place. Cause I had started fostering kittens because at the Chicago Animal Pound at that point, they had serial outbreaks of distemper, which is a fatal disease that kills cats. And they were just euthanizing all the kittens or just killing them all. Cause they just thought, you know, we can't prevent these kittens from getting it. We don't have enough space. We've got to clear out all the cages and, you know, basically sanitize them all. So we have no room for any animals and a kitten's not going to survive anyway. So they said, the original reason I took these seven kittens and Annie was because the volunteer director came to me and said, they're all going to die today unless you take them. And I was like, all right, I'm taking them. Hmm. I'd saved these kittens and they've been a part of my life. And, you know, Natalie and I, my dog at the time, they're really starting to integrate into our families. And I bring them back and they say, we're going to have to take them back. And I'm sad about that. But I think to myself, what else can be done? And then I think it was maybe a few hours later or maybe a day later, I find out that they're euthanizing them all. Hmm. They're not actually caring for them. They're just going to kill them all. And it's because of liability concerns. You know, they don't want somebody to get a ringworm. They don't want ringworm to spread to the animals. And they hadn't told me because I think they knew, you know, I was not going to fucking be down to leave these kittens here if they're all going to be killed. So I basically just broke back into the shelter the next day and just grabbed all the kittens and took them home. And they didn't stop me. And I never went back to the shelter again. It was the last day I ever, because that wasn't a volunteer. That was a theft. Mm-hmm. What am I saying? I'm the defender of the right to rescue. It was not a theft. It was a rescue.
That was a rescue. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I saved all their lives.
And they were in your lives for how many years after that?
So that would have been 2005. Hmm. So Joan was with me for 17 years, the longest I've ever been with any living being in my life. And I lost him last year, which is just one of the hardest years of my life. But yeah, it was awful too. Cause, one of the cats actually did come down with distemper because when we brought them back to the shelter, there's a little kitten named Stripe, a little male kitten. It was actually Joan, Flash, and Stripe were the three gray kittens that were not Annie's kittens. So it was the three who had been orphaned and they'd been through hell, you know, like in the freezing cold, starving to death, having no family, being stuck in a box, going to a shelter, having just no one. And then, you know, for a few weeks, Stripe had heaven, you know, he was finally in a warm place. He had a mom, he had an adopted human dad who loved him. And then he goes back in the shelter, this terrifying cage, gets this horrible disease. And, I spent $15,000 trying to save his life when he was dying of distemper. And he still ended up vomiting blood all night and then dying in my arms as I rushed into the emergency vet. Jeez. It's one of the most awful nights of my life. Like literally projectile vomit blood all over me from distemper.
Ugh.
It was awful.
It's horrible.
Well, actually, was it projectile vomit or diarrhea? It was one or the other, but I was covered in blood everywhere. Hmm. And I was so angry. I was so angry. I wanted to go back and just like smash every cage at the shelter after that happened. Because, yeah, Stripe was, I mean, all three of them. Like I was connected to them. You know, it's hard to care for these extremely vulnerable beings. And yeah, one of the things about rescue is it's not just about what it does for them, it's about what it does to us. Because when you take into your hands the life of a vulnerable creature who's dying and you give them a chance, it changes you in really powerful ways. And yeah, it was a horrible experience, but you know, thank God I had Flash and Joan and the other kittens and all the others got adopted out. And Annie, I could never adopt out because she was so vicious. So she stayed with me for years. But yeah, it was hard. But again, just how flippant we are with the lives of animals. But they never did anything about it. You know, I just took these kids. They're like, what do we do about this guy? I think it's partly because I threatened them. I told them, you know, I was a law student at the time. But I said, I'm going to sue you guys. And I'm going to make a lot of problems for you if you come after me.
And they were probably just going to kill them anyways. So
they were going to kill them anyways. But I think they just didn't know what to do. Because on some level, I think they knew I was right. You know, that Like, I'm just trying to save these kids' lives. How can you possibly stop me from trying to save their lives? And they didn't. So Joan had a very happy 17 years, and then last year he died. But I think that was my first open rescue back in 2005.
Wow. Wow, that's incredible. And it wasn't even... Yeah, no, I never heard that story before.
Yeah, it's wild.
That's amazing.
I thought about reaching out to the guy, the volunteer director, because Charles, he was a former cop, great guy. I mean, he loved animals deeply, but he wasn't vegan. He wasn't even vegetarian. Mm-hmm. He and his wife were the people who are kind of running the volunteer program, completely, you know, unpaid. And they're both retired. He was a former cop. Interesting, too, because he was a black guy and an ex-cop in the Chicago PD, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. if you know anything about the Chicago PD, police department, both in terms of the violence that they inflicted on innocent people, including me. I mean, I had the shit beaten out of me by Chicago police a few times, which totally a different story. But then I'm especially a black person, you know? Mm-hmm. So Charles was like a interesting guy because his wife was white. He was a black man on the Chicago Police Department, retired. But he just had like partly I think because of just the weird demographic and racial and political position he had found himself in. He had like a just interesting take on life. He was more open to things. And so when I talked to him about stuff like animal rights, he was pretty open to it. Hmm. And maybe one of the reasons they did stop me was because Charles was like, I mean, I'm a cop. Just let this one go away. This guy is a little out of control and he did barge in, quote unquote, steal our cats, but he's doing the right thing. But I never talked to Charles again after that because I was so angry. And I think maybe I should reach out to him just because he might be the reason I was able to keep Joan. Because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. he was a cop. I mean, he had friends. I'm sure he could have called one of his buddies up and had me arrested, frankly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he made the right decision, and maybe that's why I was able to save Joan. And yeah. I had, you know, my best friend for 17 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think you should definitely try and make contact, and it would be an incredible story to see kind of his perspective on the situation. And
yeah, he might not be alive. He was an older gentleman. So... yeah, it's wild. So what were you thinking about before your first open rescue? Actually, can I let's walk us back. Do you remember when you recall us first start talking about rescue and the importance of rescue?
I mean, it was early. Yeah. It was early on. I think we had considered it as like a powerful tactic. But I don't think we started talking about it like this is something that we're going to do, right? It was just something that was like kind of in the ether, like that we had. I mean, I don't even recall where we, you know, or why in what context. But I do remember we had just considered it as a particularly powerful form of action. But I don't even think I don't remember even explicit discussions before it even kind of started. That we said like this is going to be something that we do and this is going to become a primary kind of component of our actions. What do you recall?
I think we're at your house, and I recall for the first time just discussing a lot of things about what we could do, and you know we were talking about creative disruptions and protest tactics, mm-hmm. mobilization, and community events and theory. So much of those early conversations was just theory.
Yeah.
Right. Debates about speciesism and abolitionism and welfarism. Because that was like the entire movement back then. I mean, there were debates about welfarism, but they were entirely kind of oriented around this guy, Yuri Francione, who was just such a jerk that it kind of discredited the entire abolitionist movement. Mm-hmm. You know, his position was, you know, basically not vegan if you support any animal welfare reforms, because what does it matter if you sing to the animals on the way to the slaughterhouse? What does it matter if you play Mozart for a pig when she's trapped in a gestation crate? Her rights are still being violated. And he's got a good point, but he was just such a jerk about it to everybody that no one wanted to be around him. But so we were talking about, we had all these theoretical conversations. We convinced Chris that speciesism is not okay.
Yeah.
Because one of the co-founders of DAC, this is great. I actually love this story because it shows how open we were to disagreement, but and how like we had this curiosity and this intellectual kind of energy to the space in the early days. But we had, you know, this guy who we meet, and you know, I think it was probably the summer of 2012 or shortly thereafter, maybe it was mm-hmm. the fall or winter, who's coming and saying, "No, I'm a speciesist. I think it's okay to mistreat animals. They're lesser than us." And we're like, all right, let's make you a co-founder of an animal rights organization. No, but I mean, we had all these discussions, and much to Chris and later Cristobal, because Chris changed their name to Cristobal and started identifying as non-binary a few years later. But we did change Cristobal's mind just through logic and reasoning and storytelling and say, like, oh, actually, why is it that we think animals are less than us? It's not just that we shouldn't be cruel to them, but they're equal, mm-hmm. you know, at least in all the ways that matter. And, you know, that's something Jeremy Bentham saw, what, 300 years ago, mm-hmm. and made the argument very compellingly. And Peter Singer made it in 1975 with Animal Liberation. But I think after months of these theoretical conversations, and I actually think those theoretical conversations are pretty important. And I think mm-hmm. it's one of the things that's really missing from the movement today. Everybody's just on Twitter, like blasting, you know, like the most serious, thoughtful things I'm seeing on the internet are people commenting on dumb influencer videos like mine. And I'm glad people are commenting on my dumb influencer videos, but that's not a substitute for like a real substantive theoretical conversation. But after long theoretical debates, discussions for months, I think it was probably winter of 2012 at some point, or maybe it was early 2013, maybe it was even after that first video that we made. We were sitting in your house and we started talking about how, you know, somebody's just got to break that door down and start taking the animals out. Mm-hmm. And then we looked at each other and said, wait, you're somebody. So am I. Like, you know, you're somebody. So am I. Wait, we're all somebody. And I don't even remember who first said it, but somebody said that. Like, somebody's just got to break these door downs, take the animals out.
Yeah, this is, it sounds like something you would say.
It might have been me. Yeah, it does sound like this. Yeah, I would say. But I just know somebody said that, and everyone, I just remember the entire, like, everyone's eyes lit up. I mean, like, mm-hmm. that's right. We just have to rescue the animals. That's it. You know, like, it's not that complicated. There's all these, because, you know, there's so many books that are written and TED Talks and discussions about persuasion and then animal rights. You have all these, like, nonprofits that have started, animal charity evaluators, Faunalytics, animal think tank. And I'm not saying there isn't a lot of value in all those conversations, but sometimes the answer is quite simple. Mm-hmm. Just bring to life the world you want to create. If you think animals should be saved, just fucking save the animals and the world will change.
And yeah, I think
that's true.
Yeah, yeah. And I definitely think that was kind of, I think our two personalities kind of paired pretty well in that regard, because I think I was the think tank. I mean, you're the everything, but I was the think tank type person. I was like, well, wait a minute, Wayne, maybe we should have some more discussions. Maybe we should read another, you know, fucking philosophical text about this before we do anything.
Which is great. We don't have that much in the movement anymore.
Yeah. But I mean, at the same time, like, and this is where, I mean, you've persuaded me into this, and I've seen this in my other types of, you know, non-animal rights work now. It's like, you just have to do things and you have to you have to be willing to make mistakes and learn from those mistakes, but you have to do it. And that's like the best way to move forward with anything. And you really kind of were the engine that drove us in that direction. Whereas I was like, wait a minute, maybe not yet. We should get a little more prepared.
The engine on the train. You were the train director, making sure we didn't go off a cliff.
You're
the one who said, like, wait a minute, hold the horn, you know, warn people are on our way. Let's not crash.
Yeah.
It was interesting. I mean, so my experience of that all was very different, because I knew from the day I met all of you that I wanted to do rescue. And mm-hmm. it's weird, because I'd always done rescues. I mean, I had rescued, you know, chickens and cats and all sorts of animals at that point. And it was a huge part of my life before I moved to the Bay Area and my mom got sick. And I'd always wanted to do open rescue, but I was like afraid, kind of. And it's weird, too, because if you recall, the other thing that was kind of scary, which is why I'm a little surprised that you were not concerned about the legal risks back in 2013 and 14 when we started doing this work, the movement was so paralyzed by fear at that point. Everyone was so scared of the AATA. And this is one of the reasons everyone was like, the most ambitious thing we could do is sofritas at Chipotle, because everyone was so scared that you can't challenge these big industries. And for me, I don't think the fear was even legal fear. Cause I, like, if you recall back in 2012 and 2013, one of the biggest things I was doing with everybody as a lawyer was just telling people, look, the things people say about the ATA just aren't true. You know, you cannot get prosecuted under the ATA just for leafleting. That's mm-hmm. so many people told me there was a law that was passed in 2007. Maybe it was 2006. It might have been 2006.
I think it was 2006, yeah.
Yeah, it was 2006, called the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, that made it an act of federal terrorism punishable by many years in prison to do property damage or cause a threat of violence to be delivered to an animal enterprise or an individual associated with the animal enterprise. And a very good friend of mine and yours to some extent too, Lauren Gazzola, had gone to prison, not under the AETA, but under the predecessor, which wasn't even as severe. Like the less severe version of the AETA was called the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. And partly because of Lauren's case, which mostly involved her running a website, I kid you not. I mean, whatever you want to say about the rhetoric on the website was a little violent and aggressive at times, but it was still a website. Because she ran a website protesting vivisection at a place called Huntington Life Sciences, she spent 5 years in prison. 5 years in prison. And she was convicted and sentenced in 2006. And partly because of this act, which was the more severe version of the statute that Lauren was imprisoned under, the entire animal rights movement was terrified. And what I told people is, you know, the Shack 7 case was an aberration in a lot of ways, but the main reason her case was messed up, not because she and her website were not engaged in any violent rhetoric. It was messed up because violent rhetoric should be protected. Mm-hmm. And the problem is by 2012 and 2013, partly because of fear mongering, even within the movement, because I think there were a lot of people who just like to talk about these things. And I won't even name names because I think everyone was acting in good faith, but I definitely felt like there was this, you know, echo chamber. There was increasing the fear within the movement. Mm-hmm. People were convinced that if I say anything at all, even if it's not violent rhetoric, I could end up in prison. And that's just not true. You know, the AETA is very clear. There are two prongs under the AETA. One is property destruction, physical property destruction. I think by 2012 or 2013, there'd even been a federal court case saying property means actual physical damage, like vandalism. It's not just lost profits. And second is a threat, like saying, I'm going to kill you. Those are the two things that the AETA in theory covered. And you had literally probably thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands of animal rights activists thinking just handing out a Why Vegan leaflet is going to place me in a federal prison under terrorism charges. Mm-hmm. So I didn't think that the AETA was that much of a risk. I did think there could be prosecutions, and you know, there have been prosecutions. I honestly didn't think they'd be quite as serious as they've been. I didn't think they would dare bring a racketeering charge, for example, or these big conspiracy cases against the animal rights activists, which, you know, I was just convicted and put in jail on one of these conspiracy cases. But I didn't think federal terrorism charges were that likely for open rescue. Mm-hmm. I think what I was scared of more than anything was not the legal repression. I think what I was scared of was the movement's reaction. Because it just felt to me when a movement has become so afraid and so unwilling to challenge these big systems to the point that we're cheerleading for Whole Foods and our biggest victory is sofritas, like vegan tofu at Chipotle. The idea of a group coming forward and saying, no, we're just going to break down the doors and take the animals out was going to cause such an intense backlash and just would not. I think I was just afraid we'd fail because, you know, the movement would just not get it. Like I guess I was afraid. I didn't believe our message was actually as strong as it ultimately was. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't sure. And, you know, and history proved me wrong in that fear because people were fucking inspired. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they have been for many years. Mm-hmm. So anyways, that was probably my biggest fear. I think, like, I knew it'd bring a lot of attention to us. I don't think I quite realized how much hate and vitriol it'd create even within the movement. And the hate within the movement is definitely much worse than the hate outside of the movement. Because honestly, outside of the movement, we haven't faced that much hate. It's just, other than the mayoral campaign in 2020, you know, most people outside of the movement have been super supportive of the work. They thought this is like really, really important, inspiring work. Mm-hmm. But the hate within the movement, I think, it's weird. The backlash definitely happened, but the backlash wasn't what I expected it to be. It wasn't just like, oh my God, you're going too far. It was just, like this weird resentfulness.
Yeah. No, it was like, it wasn't you're going too far, but it was like, yeah, you were actively, you were hurting animals. You were harming the movement. That was, I mean, that was the reaction, was not that we were just making the movement look bad, that we were actively undermining the movement. And as a result, animals were going to die because of it.
Yeah. It's weird though, because it just, people would say that, but it would always be about random other stuff. Like, I mean, honestly, to put a name on one of the critics, like Jay Conroy, the cranky vegan, it was like, he did have an internal critique to our strategy saying, why are you doing above ground active? You're just going to get arrested and thrown in jail, which is a total legitimate point to make, because he has served prison time himself. He's a hero to the movement for that reason. His sacrifices should be honored. And I think he's a legendary activist. He's made some of the best videos in animal rights history. I think he's a really, really smart guy. But they never really directly made that claim. Or if they did, it never gained any traction. No one cared about the critique. It's like from day one, I mean, like the wild stuff they were saying about us and race, you know, like a bunch of white people accusing us of being white supremacists. That was just creepy and weird.
Yeah. And the fact that other people didn't think that was absurd at the time. Sorry. Like I look back and I was like, how the fuck did they accuse? And it was mostly you and other people of color. Yeah, who they were saying were white supremacists.
White supremacists.
And like, it was really KKK. It was white people saying this. And people were like, oh yeah, I think they might actually be right. Like you were actively like a member of some white supremacist. No, not you were just, oh, you harbored some bad ideas. Like you were actively supporting like white supremacy, which is, I mean, it's just so absurd that people actually believe that. But you know, when you have motivation to dislike, then you know, I guess you'll believe pretty much anything.
Yeah, that was wild. And they would be posting all of our events. You know, do you remember like the Bunny Alliance would post on all of our events? Just this innocuous sounding animal rights group would say on all our events, just like every, it's just, how do you have the time to do this all day? And I wish it were infiltrators. I wish I could say these were forces from the industry, but I don't think it was. I think it was just animal rights activists who had this weird political narcissism that, you know, if we have a disagreement about any one issue, you just have to decide I'm going to spend the rest of my time trying to destroy you. You know, it's pretty interesting too, because I think I might write about this. I think I'd be interested in your take on this, but I think what happens in movements sort of foreshadows what's happening in the rest of society. Because the amount of disinformation we faced in 2013, 14, 15, and have continued to face, and just the intense conflicts of our identity politics, and not even really substantive conflicts, but just absurd, ridiculous conflicts, like a bunch of white people accusing me and Priya, both of whom have faced very serious racism. I mean, Priya came here in 2001 as a Sikh woman with a family of people who wore turbans. She's not actually Muslim, but she, you know, and her family very much look Muslim, and they're part of a faith that was attacked and literally had people murdered for being Muslim when they're not actually Muslim, because Sikh people are not actually Muslim. It's kind of a subset of Hinduism from India, but people confuse them for Muslims. She came to this country in 2001, shortly before 9/11, and had people accosting her, shouting at her, violently threatening her, you know, for being brown skin. I've literally had my face sliced open by someone calling me an ugly chink, and I still have a scar on my lip. I had a Joker smile for like 6 months. Like I had a Joker smile on the left side of my face. And somehow the accusation that we are white supremacists rather than victims of white supremacy gained enormous traction in the animal rights movement for like years. It was like a year or two. And then it died and everyone forgot about it. No one in the movement now even remembers any of these things. But it's like, but that's kind of where the world's gone. Where, I mean, Donald Trump is the best standard bearer for this, but I think Democrats are doing this just as much as Republicans. I think it's dangerous on all sides, but there's such a disconnection from reality in politics that's just incredibly disturbing. Do you get the sense that, do you feel like our experiences have foreshadowed the rest of society over the last 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't thinking so much of that, but I mean, I just think the way that, or at least in like, kind of in like radical leftist circles, how kind of the terminology, like safe spaces, things like that, how that was like not really talked about so much in mainstream society, but now that's like the prominent thing everywhere. That like every workplace, every college campus, you know. But back in like 2010, you would only hear about that if you went to your like little radical meetup or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I definitely see like kind of that trend of influence.
Yeah. And it's weird too, because I think back in 2010, if you had told me it was just a good thing, I'd say, yeah, that's a great thing that's happening. And now I think, no, that's a terrible thing. maybe we're becoming old fogies, conservatives. We're like the old people who are no longer as radical as they once did were, and all the young people are like, ah, God, those old people, they don't get it. I don't know.
Yeah.
So why'd you, I don't even remember when I first, and I don't even know if I was the one who first talked to you about Petaluma Farms and the investigation we're doing at Whole Foods. Obviously, we had this campaign, mm-hmm. but do you remember how you decided you want to be a part of it?
I mean, I just knew instantly. I didn't have to decide. I mean, I had already, you know, thought about this for a long time. We had been in discussions, not about like this exactly, mm-hmm. but it just, I mean, instantly, I mean, I knew it was the right thing to do. And considering that there wasn't any kind of attention about what was actually happening inside these places, how animals were actually faring, what their lives were like, you know, I knew that we had to, you know, tell that story as best as we could.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even a question. I mean, honestly, I don't think there was any debate in my mind.
I don't know if I told you this, but you were definitely 100% necessary to the project. Because I thought we need someone who can handle a camera.
Yeah.
And Chris, I got better since 2013. I think I've become pretty good, honestly, with the camera. But I think you were kind of the person we were expecting to be our videographer. Because mm-hmm. you had the most experience with cameras at that point.
Yeah. I knew how to hold it steady.
You know how to hold it steady. But yeah. you also had like aesthetic judgment, right? And I still think the single best scene shot in the history of Open Rescue is shot by you. And that's the scene of Priya kind of in the darkness. Mm-hmm. It's just such a beautiful scene. Do you want to describe it? You know what I'm talking about, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's coming out of the dark. I can't even remember what angle it is, but she's coming out of the darkness and her headlamp starts illuminating the screen. And then you mm-hmm. see, May in the light being handed over the fence. That's the one you're talking about, right?
I'm talking about the one where there's a light in the dark. That's a good shot too. And you shot that one too, but there's one where there's a light in the darkness that's out of focus. And it's like you do, I don't think it was intentional, but maybe it was. I think you told me at one point, cause I asked you, did you do this intentionally? Cause this is like cinematic quality. I don't know. Mm. And you told me, I thought it was just accidental. Cause I mean, we're all frantic and nervous and we got this dying hand in our arms trying to rush out of this place. And I just said, how did you do this? And you said, it's partly accidental, but you had a thought about it. You were mm-hmm. thinking about it, but there's a light in the darkness that's totally out of focus. And you just see this blurry and you hear some voices in the video. And then as the camera's approaching, it comes into focus and you see just Priya looking down with this really beautiful, compassionate face at this hen who's dejected and collapsed in her arms. Mm-hmm. And she comes into focus and she looks up and you see her and you see a hand in the background too. That's like next to the light. It's just such a beautiful shot. I've mm-hmm. used it so many times in videos and it's still like to me the most iconic scene in Open Rescue history, because for a variety of reasons. One is it just shows like out of darkness can come light and mm-hmm. beauty and love. But also it just, there's something about the entire scene and like the resoluteness in Priya's face and even the hand in the darkness. I've pointed to this in a lot of trainings. There's like a hand in the darkness you see in the video and it just represents the power of the movement, you know? Mm. If we take action, we can get these animals out. And and the fact that everything's blurry and uncertain at first is almost just this metaphorical story about the entire movement. We're all confused and uncertain about what to do. We know about this suffering. We know these animals are being brutalized. We know corporations are breaking the law. And it's so confusing and we're not sure what to do. But if we just get closer to it and start just looking, you know, without fear at the problem, it just materializes in front of us. And that scene just shows the entire thing. Mm-hmm. I'll include a link to that scene in the show notes so people can see it because it's just a beautiful scene. Do you know what I'm talking about now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, I mean, obviously your interpretation of it is much more. I did not plan that.
You did not think about all those things on the spot.
No. I mean, I think I vaguely had this idea of like, I want to see like a headlamp coming out of the darkness and illuminating the screen. So I had that kind of composition in my mind, but obviously mm-hmm. the focus and all those things that just came kind of naturally and was unplanned.
Yeah, well, just
it was a little, it was a mix of, I think, a little bit of both.
Yeah, it's funny because I've now learned how documentary makers and movie makers do those sorts of focus pulls, like where you know, basically something's really blurry and it comes into focus, and they have all these fancy machines and all this gear they do.
Yeah, that was autofocus.
No, I don't know what you did, but it's just it's like from a movie. It's so good. It's so good, and it is 100% the most used scene in open rescue videos, because we've done more open rescue videos than anybody, and you know, I've probably used it 100 times in videos. It's so good. I mean, it helps that Priya is just absolutely gorgeous. Obviously, she's such a beautiful person inside and out. I mean, she's just beautiful, and like her face is so powerful. And and you see little May like really dejected, but you can see her like coming back to life too, because by that point she had actually lifted her head up. And yeah. I don't know. I mean, that one scene just represents everything about what we're trying to do for the entire world. And it's why I think it's so important for everyone to be involved in this, you know, to be that hand in the darkness, to give aid to the animal who needs us.
So can I ask, after your experience, kind of, you know, that was in what, 2014? And it's been 10 years now. And you've done lots of open rescues. You've faced lots of consequences from your actions. I mean, if you were to do it over again or redo it, kind of, what is something that you think we got right and something that you think should be not replicated or done over?
The mistakes are a laundry list. A laundry list of laundry lists. There's so many mistakes you made. And it also just the immense success we had despite those mistakes shows the power of the strategy. One of the big ones is, and this is, you know, 100% on me, on our team, which we had just such a brilliant team. Just all the people came together, even in that first open rescue, you know, as much as Chris Duvall is not at least my fan. I don't know what your relationship with them is, but Brian and Priya, I think it was the five of us, right? Brian, me, Priya, you, the five of us. And all five of those people played such crucial roles. And, you know, Brian was just such a dynamite speaker and advocate. Priya had this intense charisma about her in organizing. And, you know, she just relates to people better than almost anybody I know. You know, I had like a vision, you know, I was always the person who had like big visions and big dreams and sometimes don't reach them, but I always wasn't afraid to rev up the engine on the train and hopefully we don't go over the cliff. Like you were providing like a lot of the groundwork for what we were doing and then ended up writing a piece in Savia that was an amazing piece. And Cristobal, it's interesting, even though they ended up not continuing to play this role, they were very much like a median influence. They like connected everyone and, you know, there was just someone. And I think one of the things that was really beautiful about that initial group is we really just cared about each other. You know, I feel like we really did care about each other and we still do. You know, I miss Brian. I miss Chris too. I miss Brian a lot. He works at this legal startup now in the Bay Area. Did you know he works with Samer?
No, yeah. I had no idea.
Huh. He worked at this artificial intelligence startup.
Interesting. Very interesting.
I'll tell you about that later. Okay. We should try it. If you're down, we should try and connect to Brian before.
Absolutely.
Anyways,
yeah, but I love Brian. He's a great guy.
So, but, the other role I played was I was a lawyer for the team and I gave everyone legal advice, I'm sure, and represented everyone because I believed at the time and I still believe that everything we were doing on that day was legal. But we didn't really have a legal strategy. And I think that was a huge mistake. And we are correcting the mistake, the new open rescue experience. Have you done the new open rescue experience?
If it's been in the past year or two? Yeah, then yes.
It's the one where we ask people to go through jury instructions and teach people about you know, how to find a good lawyer. So I think that's crucial. You just need that, especially in today's climate where the chances you're going to be prosecuted are so much higher than they were back in 2012 and 2013. You know, I'd say it's like back then we did so many open rescues from 2015, or actually starting in 2014 all the way through 2018 before they started. You know, they're basically 4 years of dozens of open rescues where they didn't respond at all. And suddenly in 2018, every one of them was leading to charges. So one is legal strategy. Another is having a better filter. I think we were just lucky, honestly. And honestly, if if Cristobal had gotten really upset at us back in 2014 and 2015, that could have ruined the project, right? And Cristobal got upset at us later, thank God. It was like 4 years later that they ended up getting super upset and, you know, starting a bunch of fights and leaving. But it was just kind of luck that the five people who did that got along really well. And there were no conflicts that ever broke us apart until much later. Mm-hmm. But maybe one of the biggest mistakes is, I think from day one, we should have been not just cultivating leadership in others and identifying people who could take people on teams. Like, I don't even know if I sat down with you and said, do you want to lead an open rescue? Mm-hmm. Did I ever?
No, you didn't.
I probably should have, you know, I probably should have, like, cause you're certainly capable of it. 100%. Mm-hmm. You could have done it, but, and I did do that with some people. Like I definitely did it with like Julianne. Cause I know this, cause I, you know, Julianne was just always someone who, Julianne was an amazing activist who's super smart, like just brilliant woman, and also beautiful and charismatic and wonderful in so many ways, who's no longer part of the movement. And she ended up doing the first open rescue of a dairy cow in US history. And she did that on her own. Like she called me at the late stage just as muscle, you know, because she needed someone to help carry a 120-pound cow. That was literally my
literal muscle. Like, yeah.
Yeah. She was like, come and be muscle. We don't need you for anything else. Because it was going to be an all-woman project. And it was an all-woman project until the very late stage. We're like, yeah, I mean, we need some muscle. And, you know, surprisingly, even though I'm a dork, I'm pretty strong. So she asked me
You're
to help out.
Dork.
I'm a rip dork. Yeah. But we never cultivated leadership. And I think if I were to do this over, not only would we be very, very intentional about trying to cultivate leadership in others, but we would be trying to cultivate leaders who can cultivate more leaders. Mm-hmm. Right? Because I think one of the major bottlenecks we saw wasn't even so much that we didn't have enough leaders, because we did end up having a lot of leaders, like, you know, Matt Johnson, Julianne Perry, Alexandra Paul, Priya. There were all sorts of people ended up leading open rescues after we started doing open rescue trainings across the country. But the one thing that no one else did, I think, nearly as well as I did, and it's just, this is partly because I just didn't plan for it and I didn't strategize around it, was I was not cultivating leaders who were cultivating other leaders. Mm. You know, if all the mentorship is happening through me, that is a massive bottleneck that is going to prevent this from growing. Well, if we actually create programs and structures and training programs, and to a certain extent, we did. Like, there were other people who did open rescue trainings, not just me, and there's still other people doing open rescue trainings. But a huge part of effective leadership development is relationship management and relationship development. Like, it wasn't just that Julianne did an open rescue training. She did. It was that I sat down and had a coffee with her. We watched videos together. We cried together. You know, we became close to each other. She believed that I had her best interest in her heart. And I still do, you know, many years later, even though she's not a part of the movement. I trained her in China. You know, like, we went to China together, risked our lives together. And then she came back and then organized open rescues herself. So it wasn't just the training. It wasn't just like a training and we go home. There was a relationship that developed after that, that made her into a powerful leader. And I think we never created the culture and the protocols and the development programs that allow leaders to figure out how to lead and develop other leaders. Mm-hmm. Hmm. So those are some of the big mistakes. Mm-hmm. And those are some of the mistakes we're trying to create reverse right now. I mean, this is why we launched this YouTube show. This is why I'm having this conversation with you. Why I'm hoping someone hears this and thinks, oh, yeah, I'm understanding a little bit more about what it takes to do an open rescue. Mm-hmm. So that's the hope. And I think it's not just a hope. I think it can happen. We need to be more intentional and strategic about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's people out there, and I'm sure there's people out there that are more than capable than you even. And kind of, you know, directing these projects and growing them. So
maybe I'm talking to one of them right now.
Nah,
you want to leave your job and start leading open rescues again, Ronnie?
Yeah. I'm a good support player. Let's just, you may say leader, I say supporting sure cast.
What do you see as our biggest mistakes if you could go back to 2014 in that rescue? And even just what developed after that, not just in that rescue, but after that, what do you see as the big mistakes?
I mean, honestly, I think it was also leadership. I think we kind of, we had a good democratic principle from the beginning of mm-hmm. kind of inviting everybody and anyone in and trying to share power. I think we did that. We did the sharing of the power very well. But I do think kind of in retrospect how important leadership is, and having stable leadership that can kind of weather conflict well. And, you know, I think that ended up kind of transitioning in that direction later, but I do think we were a little too idealistic in our ability in our thoughts of that, oh, we could just invite anybody in, without, you know, kind of a filter process. And so long as they're interested, you know, they have as much power as anybody else. And so in principle, I think it's good, but at the same time, I don't think it's not sustainable, I think, in the long run, especially with higher risk, you know, projects. And especially when conflicts come into play, you know, it just gets, you need somebody who, or not somebody, but maybe, you know, a team of people who can you know, lead you out of the situation. The ship.
Yeah, do you remember the first big mini opportunity we had with the Stanford paper?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it got squandered.
Yeah, and we let somebody, I mean, it was in many ways a cool thing about our culture, but we let someone who just had joined, basically. This is after we did this big disruption at a screening of American Meat at Stanford, and we were condemned by the Stanford paper for protesting because it was a Chipotle-funded and screened film all about how the meat industry is great and look at Chipotle and how wonderful, you know, they're saving the environment and caring for animals. And it was all just a lie. It was like total propaganda funded by a corporation. It was weird that seemingly intelligent Stanford students were buying it. And then, so we disrupted it and got a lot of flack for it, including the animal rights movement. So many people hated us. You know, I mean, it wasn't even that bad of a disruption. Like it wasn't that aggressive. Like I apologized at the end of it. I said, I'm sorry, everybody. Do you remember that?
Yeah. That, it's funny that you say that, because I don't know if I would have advocated for that action now these days. Really? Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if it was I think it was important for us, like, you know, in our relationships and trying to do something and, you know, experimenting and, you know, building our resolve. But I don't know if I agree with the action so much. Obviously, I agree with the message against the film, but I don't know. I do think there's a space for public forums and debate to take place. And I do think we should allow those things to happen, even if it's, you know, viewpoints that we kind of really disagree with.
Basically, so you're thinking because you don't think we should deplatform even Chipotle.
Well, I mean, I think the forum that it was happening in should have gone on because there were people on the panel who were going to represent that side, you know, and it should have, I don't know where I land on it.
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, it did happen.
It did happen. So we didn't shut it down. We just did our thing and then left. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it either. Like, I know afterwards everyone was feeling very, very discouraged from that demonstration because it was an intense experience. That was probably our first extremely intense experience out of many, many intense experiences we had over the next 10 years, because the crowd was booing and hissing and they wanted, you know, they were saying, threatening to call the police on us. And you know, from my perspective, it was like, all we did was, do you remember what we did actually? We had pictures of animals were important to us.
Yeah.
You know, I just like had a picture of Lisa, my pit bull, who I saved from a dog fight. Me, and I said, you know, something like, this is Lisa and she didn't deserve to die, or she doesn't deserve to die. She wasn't dead at the time. She's passed since then. And everybody just got, so one by one, everyone got up out of their seats during the Q&A after the film. I didn't even watch it. It's just a terrible movie. I mean, everyone's forgotten about it because it's a terrible movie, as every corporate funded documentary is. They're all awful. But so during the Q&A, each of us got up and held up a sign that had a picture of an animal who was in our lives. Some cases dogs, cats, but some cases chickens, cows, other animals that someone had a relationship with from visiting at a sanctuary, and just said, this is Lisa and she doesn't deserve to die. And everyone did the same. And then people would say, get up and say that. And then they get up at the front of the audience and they did block off the speakers and just hold these signs up. And then I did a little speech and people were like booing and hissing and standing up and, like, you know, I don't know if they physically threw anything at us, but it certainly felt like they're about to. I mean, I think
it was the moderator more than anyone who was really aggressive.
Oh, that's right. There was a woman there. That's right.
She had it in for you and she
hated us. Yeah.
And you specifically.
Yeah.
I mean, you were the one.
Why do people hate me so much, Ronnie?
I don't know.
I think I just got a face
like that. Yeah, you got a
hateable
face.
People just want to punch me. They look at that face and they say, I just want to slug that guy. Yeah. That happened yesterday when I was talking to Richard. I felt like Richard wanted to slug. I'm just kidding, Richard. Richard, Vegan Gains is great. He called me a hypocrite and a scumbag, but I think he still likes me on some level. I don't know, maybe not. But yeah, so, and then afterwards, I mean, people were really shaken up by it. I remember there was a Stanford student who worked with us up to that point, and she left and never came back after that. Yep. She was like, this is way too intense for me. But I think it was actually a good experience for us because it just, we went, and the reason is afterwards we went to Garden Fresh, like this vegan restaurant in Palo Alto, and we all hung out and we talked about it. And there was something about the solidarity that in the face of this really, really intense backlash that made all of us stronger and more resolute in the future. That, you know, I 100% agree with you. That tactic was not nearly as important as Open Rescue. Or even, I mean, it wasn't the best disruption we did. I still think, actually, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts about what you think the best creative disruption we did was. But before you answer that, I'll just say, it's not the best tactic. But even a bad tactic that leads to backlash and maybe even a counterproductive tactic creates learning and solidarity in a way that other forms of activism that don't involve risk taking do not. There's something about taking that risk together that just makes you stronger, both in your personal convictions, but then also in your connection to the movement, which was really powerful. So if you thought that action was crap, what was your favorite? I mean, other than the Open Rescues, like what do you think was your favorite? Or I shouldn't say your favorite. What do you think was the most effective? Do you think our first demonstration was effective?
No.
Really?
No, I think it was for the same reason. I think it was because it helped build kind of we were building our theory of change, right? You know, by doing it and figuring things out and also our relationships through these actions. And so like the important point, maybe not even was so much the action, it was the afterwards, you know, kind of debrief and hangout that, you know, helped us feel more kind of committed to the cause. I don't know. I mean, I think I remember Chipotle had these festivals that they were doing in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park for a couple of years, which I mean, it's just crazy to even think about, like these corporate sponsored festivals that were like music and events. And there was like cooking, demonstrations and stuff. And there was the one where Brian disrupted this, I don't know, some famous chef. I don't know anything about this world, but it was some famous chef who was going to go up there and, you know, show everybody how you butcher a pig or something. And he got up and poured blood all over himself and held up a sign. And I think it said like,
he laid himself down on the table.
Oh, yeah.
If I remember correctly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was half naked.
Yeah. Like that was the kind of disruption that I was like, that was very much worth it. Yeah.
Interesting. What's the difference between that and like the grill palm? Cause that video didn't actually do that well, surprisingly.
The video of that disruption that Brian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's probably because their video footage just wasn't that great though.
I just didn't think it was very interesting. Yeah. It was not aesthetically pleasing. It was kind of.
You mean the grill palm, our first action?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, for the record, everyone who's listening, if it was a bad action, it's Ronnie's fault because he edited the video. So if it sucked, you're responsible.
Yes.
I'm not going to say mother effer because I'm trying to curse less. So.
Yeah. No, I am absolutely responsible. Please direct all anger
direct
messages
all hate towards
me.
Ronnie Rhodes for DXE number one. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think I still think creative disruption has a really important role. I wish people focus more on the creative and less on the disruption. Because I think that was a huge part of what we were focused on in the early stages. And that's part of what made the activism cool rather than just like annoying and shrill, that we're always doing something unique and different and weird. And I think the thing that took the creative out of disruption was actually, ironically, disrupt speciesism. Do you remember this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just went viral. And it was like the first time it happened, it was cool. So disrupt speciesism was this hashtag that went viral. And this is kind of the way DXE and grassroots activism in our circles ran back in 2014 or whenever disrupt speciesism went viral. But it was not something that the core team had planned. It was not something anyone had discussed. We were just doing like creative actions like guerrilla poems. We froze in place outside of a Louis Vuitton. You know, we had someone pour blood on themselves and jump onto a table at a Chipotle festival celebrating meat. And Priya and Kelly were just hanging out at the house one day and said, like, we should just go disrupt species. Let's just go into a restaurant and just disrupt everybody. Like, shut the entire dinner down and give a speak out and just hold a sign. You know, I don't even remember exactly what Priya and Kelly said, but Priya is in particular, like, really blew up. And they get, like, thousands of shares because she got pretty violently assaulted. That was the thing. And then after that, we had a couple other people do stuff, like Missy in Central California. You remember Missy and Nick? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Missy did one that went kind of viral. And it's weird. There were a lot of dimensions to it. It's weird. Like, this is, I'm just going to be honest with everyone. One of the things that made some of these videos go viral is, like, there were a bunch of beautiful women doing these things, you know, like, and that's, I've just looked at the metrics. I mean, if you look at the videos, especially on YouTube, because YouTube's all these guys, you know, Instagram too, though, like, beautiful women get a lot of attention, and it's shitty and stupid and superficial, but it's just also true. And it's like one of these weird things that you have to reckon with as an animal rights activist or someone who's trying to get attention, you know, but there's a reason that some things get more attention than others. And I think one of them was that, you know, Priya is just beautiful. And she's like this beautiful, elegant looking woman yelling in a restaurant, a fancy restaurant in Oakland, getting dragged out physically. And then everyone just started repeating it. And that became the thing. That was like everything DXC did became that. And you and I both did one, like you videotaped me getting dragged out of a Ruth Chris. I think we did a couple of them. Do you remember this? Yeah,
we did a few. The one I remember is the one in Baltimore.
Yep.
Where I actually felt like we were going to get our asses kicked in an alleyway.
Yeah. Those security guards were pretty intense. They were coming after us.
No, they weren't even security guards. They were just like the valet guys. They just wanted to fight someone. I don't think they, they didn't really care about the message. They just,
yeah. I don't know. But that just became very entrenched. It was just, at that point, it was part of the DNA of DXC. And it's weird because it was not a planned thing. It's completely spontaneous. And in some ways it was beautiful because it was just something that happened. And then we invested in it afterwards because it obviously was very successful in the sense there were a huge number of people supporting it. It's kind of mind blowing that those disruptions got as much support as they got because they're pretty, I mean, they're very kind of uncivil. And I remember, do you remember this video Sanjeev did? So we made this video with Sanjeev. Sanjeev Deshpande is an amazing animal rights activist. He's a software engineer. But he's like an older Indian guy, Hindu, you know, very, very polite, civil guy, like just one of the most polite people you could possibly meet. But he's a very dedicated animal rights activist. He believes deeply that animals should not be hurt. And he got involved in DXC partly because of that video. And we made this video where we asked him, you know, why did this video appeal to you? I mean, you're like such a polite, civil Indian guy. And you watch this Indian woman. Part of it is obviously she's Indian. And, you know, these sorts of identity connections do make a difference. Like, I've talked to so many Chinese people who have seen me and so like, I didn't realize there was a place for Chinese people. And now I've seen it. And just, it's really important to have that identity connection. But one of the things he says in the interview, which is hilarious, he said, I'd never seen an Indian woman behave in such uncivil fashion.
Yeah. Okay. I remember.
He says that to me, he's like, but it was attractive to him. He said, cause it was so different from what I expected. Cause you normally think, oh, Indian woman, very polite, especially like an elegant, beautiful looking Indian woman who just looks like, you know, an Indian woman you might see working in a tech firm or something like that. But instead, she's barging through this restaurant with a sign yelling at people about species, meaning it physically attacked by all the restaurant workers. And it really didn't inspire people that, you know, people are kind of coming out of the woodwork and advocating for animals. So, I don't know. But I think that same thing is true about Open Rescue. And I think Open Rescue should be creative too. It is a form of disruption. It's physically disrupting the violence against the animals that's happening. But maybe the most important creative element of Open Rescue is just the storytelling, because every story is a little bit different. You know, May's story was so unique and so beautiful. And I still think in terms of individual animal rescues, the most powerful story of the animals we rescued is definitely Oliver's, because, you know, he's sitting right next to me and he's my little guy. And I mean, it's transformative for me. But honestly, I don't think we did a good job of telling Oliver's story. I still think May's Open Rescue was the best story we ever told. Would you agree with that?
What do you think? I think in terms of focus on the individual animal. But I mean, it's hard. It takes time. And it takes somebody who actually knows them and spends a lot of time around them to be able to accurately represent kind of another being's personality, right? Mm-hmm. Who can't necessarily represent themselves. So there's a lot more labor involved.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's actually another mistake that I think we made that we probably are still making, which is the rescue of May. It was not just about the rescue. It was about the relationship. And, mm-hmm. you know, I personally and physically cared for her, and you did, and Priya did, for days, if not, I think it was maybe weeks. We were the ones who hand fed her. And then we came back to see her over and over again for years, you know, until she, not years, she died about a year later, but mm-hmm. certainly every month. And we had tons of video footage, but it wasn't just the video footage. It was just the authenticity of the account we were telling was so much more apparent and more dramatic and interesting to people. It made more clear why rescue is such an imperative, because, you know, it's just, it's hard to feel compelled to rescue an abstraction. Mm-hmm. And, but when you really know an individual and see they have the same yearnings and desires and fears and traumas that your dog might have. I mean, like when I said that May was a different hen and that the abuse she faced at the Whole Foods farm had left a mark on her, those words were true. And I believed them very deeply, and I knew them very deeply because I had seen the mark they had left on her, you know, that the abuse had left on her, because I was with her every day. Mm-hmm. I was watching her struggling to stand. I was watching her, you know, trying to lift her head up in the first couple of days just because she was so weak. And, you know, too often, I think nowadays, like rescue operations are just these kind of smash in, smash out, and you're done. And then the rest of the care is just, it's almost like an assembly line where, you know, our role is just to do the rescue, and then we move on to another rescue, move on to another rescue, instead of realizing, no, there's a story here. And there's a relationship. That part of the rescue is seeing this animal come back to life and even personally witnessing and experiencing the joy, the miracle of the recovery, which is, it's miraculous. When you see these animals come back to life, it's one of the best things about rescue, especially farm animals. I mean, farm animals are such gentle creatures, and they've been bred for 10,000 years to be gentle, which is one of the most horrifying betrayals of them, because, you know, pigs are basically wild boars who become domesticated to the point that they will not fight back, even though they're 700 pounds and could kill you very easily. Mm-hmm. Cows in Africa are extremely dangerous animals. Like, I think wild cattle in Africa, I think they kill more people than any other species of animal. They're extremely deadly. And then we bred them to become super gentle. So, I mean, you've met like Buddha and Rosa, right? Mm-hmm. Like these huge, I mean, yep. You see Buddha. Buddha is, he's like a tank.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's like 3,000 pounds, I think.
Oh, yeah.
He's 2,000. I mean, he's a tank. He could kill you with his head. Like, he could headbutt you and kill you. He could step on you and kill you. Like, Buddha could literally just step on you and kill you. Like, mm-hmm. not kidding. I mean, he's as big as a car. And yet he's so gentle. Like, he just moves around very softly. He doesn't want to hurt anybody. I mean, occasionally he does get a little cautious, but even when, if he really wanted to hurt you, it just shows you when he gets a little restless, it's actually quite dangerous because he's such a large animal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we have these incredibly gentle creatures, but they're also incredibly tough, you know, and May showed that because she was like beat up and who knows how long she'd been sitting there in that litter pile. And yet she fought back and she lived for a year and was tough as hell. Same with Lily and Lizzie. Same with, you know, Daisy and Edna, like the two pigs you rescued. You took part in the Farmer John investigation, right? In Central California. You did?
Okay. No.
Yeah. But we lost one of them. We rescued three piglets from Farmer John. We lost one in the first couple of weeks, and it was horribly sad because he was like shrieking in the middle of the night, and I woke up and I saw him. It's the first time I'd seen a mammal go through the death throes. Did you know the death throes are actually a real thing? Have you heard that term, the death throes? Well,
yeah, I've heard about it in like literature and stuff, but not.
Yeah,
but it's like a medical phenomenon.
Yeah, it's a real thing. And human beings and animals. I think we just don't see enough death to recognize it, but I've seen enough death that I've seen chickens. I've seen a lot of birds go through the death throes. Like a lot of birds would like start flapping and going crazy.
Yeah.
They're really, really weak until their last moment. And then they go absolutely crazy. And Chester went crazy on the day he died. Or not crazy. He was just like screaming at the top of his lungs. Like I came running into the room and I was screaming and he was screaming. And I like, I don't remember if I held him in his arms or another caretaker. We just like nestled him to his own death. Yeah, it was pretty awful. But the other two were just in his bad condition, you know, were horrible condition, just struggling, you know, they had pneumonia, horrible infections, and they fought through it somehow. Just, it's like, wow. I mean, I don't think if I lived in those conditions, I would survive very long.
You would survive
for weeks. And not only that, but we're able to recover and live a relatively normal life. It's like,
and start trusting humans again.
I know. It's amazing. And these are all stories that are only possible, though, if you have a continuing relationship. And I think too often with the rescues we're seeing today, not just by us, by others, it's just the end point is they're out of the farm. It's like, no, I mean, we have to tell their story. Like, if the story of Frederick Douglass and the anti-slavery movement was just like, Frederick Douglass ran from the plantation, yay, end of story. It's like, that's not a, that wouldn't have changed the world. But Frederick Douglass wrote an autobiography about how he overcame all the prejudices, how he became an advocate against slavery himself, you know? Like, it's an amazing story because you see the fully three-dimensional personhood of this person who is treated like an object. And we have to do the same for animals if we're actually going to succeed. So that's another mistake. We're not doing the three-dimensional storytelling we used to.
But that could be changed.
So let's change it. Well, anything else that was notable for you about that first open rescue that you want to share before we shut this down? Because we've been going an hour and 40 minutes.
No, other than it, I mean, it changes you. You know, and I think if nobody's ever taken part in an open rescue, I mean, it's something that if you have the opportunity to do, you should, because I think it brings to life this thing that's so abstract, that even if you kind of read about it in books or see it in movies or films or whatever, that you can't replace kind of that immediate kind of firsthand experience. And, yeah, it just, I mean, it kind of alters your life, or at least it did for me, and kind of strengthens your kind of conviction on how wrong these systems are.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. And we need to get more people into these places, helping the animals. Any last advice you have for folks who might be interested? What do you think helped you, if anything?
Find your Wayne. Find your Wayne, get inspired by somebody who knows what they're doing, or who's not afraid to take risks.
Smart risks. You can find me because I, you know, we're planning to relaunch the training program. So one thing people can do is come to an open rescue experience near you. If you want to host one, if you can basically get 30 people to commit to coming to, we're actually thinking about expanding it. We had previously cut down the open rescue experience from 8 hours to 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And after some recent conversations, I had some really conversations with the Animal Rising folks in the United Kingdom. And they do like an entire weekend training before their direct action campaigns. And they think you should go bigger because there's something about the bonding experience, about spending an entire weekend with a cohort of people, that really solidifies people's commitments. And I think they might be right. But if you out there listening to this show can get 30 people to 100% commit to do a training, we'll probably come out and do it with you. But I mean, I will come out and do it with you, and eventually hopefully other trainers, but we still need to refine this particular training and get into a good shape. And then we'll probably train other trainers to train. That was a lot of trains. We'll train other trainers to do the training, to train you, to become a trainer who trains others to train.
Moral of the story, get 30 people together.
Get 30 people. Find some friends. Find your voice, find some friends, and fight like hell. All right, any last words, Ronnie?
Nope. All right. I think that's it.
Well, thanks for joining, and thanks to all of you for listening. Until next time.